Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So I was on Stuart Varney's show on Fox Business yesterday, and he asked me about the March 16th deadline for the migrants, the shelters in Chicago. So where are they going to go? Because it doesn't seem obvious from what the city's communicating that they have a plan for those who are going to ostensibly be asked to leave the shelters they're at currently and don't have any identifiable place to go. So we're going to go back to sleeping in police stations and on the sidewalks in front of police stations?
Well, apparently some are going to be grandfathered in because they have special circumstances. Like, for instance, they're not going to kick the pregnant women out. But I heard from Alderman Lopez they're just going to go straight from the shelters to possibly Section 8 housing or possibly something else. But they're not. They said they're not going to allow them back in front of police stations.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to let homeless people sleep along the lakefront, which they are, you know, that's been going on and their encampment's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, you know, I know he wants to borrow $1.2 billion to build more Section 8 housing. They call it affordable housing, but that's what it is over the next 5 years. That's not going to come online fast enough. My point to Varney was, I don't know. I mean, they've eschewed the Catholic churches, the archdiocese, offer to use archdiocese properties to house the migrants for free, which would have, I guess, saved city taxpayers a bunch of money. But they didn't want to do that. Very nice of the arch to volunteer all these empty spaces they have for kids that should be going to their schools. There's that perhaps a compelled partnership out of necessity with the Arch. Arch is always willing to turn the other cheek. Or they, you know, come up with some phony baloney cover story to allow most of the migrants to stay where they're at. Or you implore the good-hearted people of Chicago to take them in, and we'll pay for you to take them in, as we're seeing in Denver and Boston and other cities. But my point was, look, this has always been a seat of the pants operation by BLM Brandon and company, right? They're not particularly good at managing things. So they're just going, trying to figure it out on the fly as they go. There's no real strategic thinking about this. But here's the one thing I know. The one thing I know is they're not going anywhere. They're staying here.
Right.
And the preeminent reason they're staying here is because CPS needs those kids in their schools.
Bingo.
Because that's the average daily allowance, or the average daily attendance, I should say, per the allowance they get from the state. That's all that matters to CPS, and that's all that matters to City Hall. You have to keep up appearances. And as, you know, American citizens who live here, black, Latino, white, and other, flee the city of Chicago, as they have over the last decade and a half now. And you see these schools that we've talked about for some time have enrollment that's a fraction of their capacity. This is the perfect opportunity to backfill, to prop up, to ensure the milk and honey continues to flow from Springfield, to pay six-figure salaries and seven-figure pensions to CPS. That's why you know they're not going anywhere. Where they stay is sort of a secondary question. Just know that they are staying.
And CTU can't have, you know, this mass exodus that's happening at certain schools. So they need the people, too. So that's why they're behind this. That's why they're not complaining about it. Because they need it. They need those students in those seats. And so what happens then? You've got people speaking like 18 different languages at a school. So thank God for Google Translate so you can know what they're saying.
What's the, it's the Tower of Babel, but what's the difference? All the English speakers, very few of them can read or do math anyway. So why? Who cares if you're able to communicate? The schools aren't in business to educate kids. They're in business to provide six-figure salaries and seven-figure pensions. That's why CPS exists.
More than to be young voters, because they're going to take them out of class this Friday for a rally outside the CTU Union Hall, and then they're going to march, a parade to the polls during school time when they should
be. Well, yeah, of course, funnel them into the political culture here. I mean, that's right. Well, that's the whole thing.
They're not going to be biased. Oh, yeah, really?
Uh-huh. So 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, if anybody knows anything else. I mean, I know we have some good Samaritans out there, like that a property owner manager that we spoke with. What was his name again?
Oh, my God.
That allowed all so many migrant families to live in the buildings that he privately owns and privately rents, and that's fine.
Check in with him, yeah.
But it was funny. Varney asked me too. He's like, "Is there a sense of panic setting in?"
Panic.
I'm like, I mean, there's some pushback, but you have to remember, Stu, most of the residents of Chicago are dead from the neck up. They don't have the capacity for panic.
Well, if they should panic about is this measles outbreak.
They have no capacity for panic, including the measles outbreak. They are just there to dutifully go in whichever direction they're pointed. And so we can talk about these issues, and cable news can try and whip up some frenzy or take a video from Mark Carter or some other sort of black conservative activist that's documenting migrant encampments or the resource allocations or the conditions in these shelters. There's no panic. There's no tumult here. There's just some people that have some sense saying this is lunacy, but that is an insular minority. Joe in Naperville, you're in Chicago's morning.
I'm going to ask the question that I guarantee you everybody's afraid to ask, but where is the legal obligation that we have to take care of these people? Nobody can answer that question. Okay, I understand that it's compassion and all that stuff, but that's not the government's role in life.
What do you mean nobody can answer that question? There's no legal obligation. I mean, what's the legal obligation to provide for homeless Americans? I mean, is there a penalty if you don't? No. So right. But I mean I wouldn't kneel at the altar of man-made law either, Joe.
Well, they can do what they want up until a point. Like that homeless encampment at Dan Ryan and Roosevelt. Dan, somebody started building and almost finished a tiny house. One of the tiny houses. Like, you know what? I want to get out of this orange tent. I'm going to build me a house on that land. So they stopped the construction of that. You know,
pay off
notices.
An alderman, get a variance, no big deal. But the question is a moral one, and we should keep it in the space of morality because the laws reflect consensus morality. Oh, by the way, I'm glad Joe asked that question because what this lawlessness represents is immorality. So if you want to have a discussion on the moral rectitude of competing positions about how to handle your border, about how to distribute scarce resources at a state or city level, we should welcome that conversation because the position we articulate on this show is the moral high ground. And the lawlessness that produces the true victimization of people is the position morally of the other side. So the kid who dies at the Pilsen shelter, the measles outbreak Amy just mentioned, and so on and so forth, because you're not competent, because you're a sentimentalist, you put people in harm's way, the very people you're aiming to represent. We say this all the time.
Right.
How is Stacey Davis Gates, how does she have the moral high ground when it comes to the education of children? Of course she doesn't. But too many people are afraid to make moral arguments because she's black and they're not, for example. So, no, this isn't about what we're legally required to do. It's about who is presenting a vision that is more in keeping with the founding principles of this nation and the theory of it, our God-given rights, the providence that guides us as we think about how to organize a free society, and welcome those who would like to belong to our free society. But there's a pathway to that, right? There's a process to that. And so many are following that process, and they're put off by line jumpers. That line jumpers don't have any moral high ground. I don't want anything bad to happen to people that are coming to this country with good intentions, and you try to help where you can, but they don't have the moral high ground either. So it's not about the law, and it's not about sort of competing sympathies and empathies. It's about who is articulating a humane vision for organizing a free society. And let me tell you something. It's not Brandon Johnson. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is rather novel.
Yeah.
A sitting governor of South Dakota, her name is Kristi Noem, as you know. She is reputedly on the short list for Trump, for his running mate. And she decided to do this commercial, basically, for a dental outfit called Smile Texas.
Smile.
Here's a portion of that ad that Kristi Noem did for Smile Texas.
Well, hi, I'm Kristi Noem. I'm the governor of South Dakota and had the opportunity to come to Smile Texas to fix my teeth, which has been absolutely amazing for years. I have needed to have an adjustment to my teeth from a biking accident, and they have been absolutely phenomenal. Years ago, I was out bike riding with all of my kids when they were little and had a biking accident and knocked out all of my front teeth. And so several years ago, I did a consultation here at Smile Texas and did it by Zoom, but could never quite find the time. And recently, got the chance to work with Dr. Davis. Dr. Dooley's always been fantastic to me, too. But the team here was remarkable and finally gave me a smile that I can be proud of and confident in. And that really is a gift that I think is going to be incredibly special to have. You know, I think that I chose the team here at Smile Texas because they're the best, first of all. I'd studied a lot of the work that they had done and talked to a lot of people that had been here, but also because they were so kind. They wanted to make sure that I was happy with my smile. Not only that the bite was correct and that I liked the shape, the color, but that it was going to work for me for the rest of my life and that it was something that I could be proud of. So For them, they care about people and about that they are happy more than they do about just fixing something to get by. They want it to be perfect. And for me, if you're going to go through a process like this, that means a lot to have someone who cares that much about the work that they do.
I mean, I could listen to her talk about Smile Texas all morning, but I think you get the gist.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I watched the whole five-minute thing and was left scratching my head, but go on. What are we going to
Well, do? I mean, the obvious question is, a sitting governor doing a infomercial for a private company, not even in her state, but even if it was in her state, and doing so in exchange for free dental work, because that was apparently the deal. That was the deal that was reported, is if she did this infomercial for Smile Texas, then they would do the dental work that she needed, as she's describing in great detail, for free.
And that dental work probably is around $10,000. Veneers are expensive.
So, as I said, teasing this before Mike Scott's news, mm-hmm. Well, you know my position on sports metaphors for politics.
Nobody can use them except for you.
Right. And so I suggested that she's the Ed O'Bannon of politics. For those who don't follow sports, Ed O'Bannon, great basketball player at the collegiate level at UCLA, went on to the pros. He sued the NCAA over their use of players' likenesses without compensation. So this was his lawsuit is basically what brought us to this place of the NIL period in college sports, name, image, likeness deals, where Caitlin Clark is making more money as a basketball player for Iowa than she will in the WNBA, although I'm sure the endorsements will continue. And you know, if you follow any, even passively, you've heard about this and you know players are being paid. Caleb Williams, if he was selected number one by the Bears, he might have been making almost as much money at USC as they'll make for the Bears, at least in his first 3 years. But so that's the deal. So let's do it for politics. Why not? Kristi Noem just broke the seal. Let's do an NIL and let's do a transfer portal. And I'll start the booster club in Illinois to get Ron DeSantis to transfer from Florida to Illinois. It's just an arms race now. You don't even have to just forget about elections. You have permanent governors and they just move about the country wherever they're wanted.
That would be great. Oh, my God. Can you imagine if he came here?
Transfer
portal. If he
was
our governor, we would just, even if he came here for a day, it would make such a difference.
What about that? What about it?
Transfer portal.
A transfer portal for politicians. And then also just, you know, again, we don't have to pay them. It's just corporations. I mean, most of them are owned by corporations anyway, so to speak. So, yeah, just let them shill for private interests and, you know. And that's how we'll do it.
I just wonder if she gets her breasts augmented. Are we going to have to see that, too, on an infomercial? Or if she gets any other work done that she likes? Well, it's just so bizarre for a sitting governor to do that. I mean, what if, like, Pritzker gets a tummy tuck or gets the lap band surgery and he wants it for free? So then he shows us all the procedure and, you know.
What if he does a phalloplasty so he could have a penis? Is he going to show us that, too? So Kristi Noem, Kristi Noem, I know people like are excited about her.
She reminds me of Sarah Palin.
That's exactly where I was going to go.
Oh, you were? Yeah. I've been saying that for a long time because every time I hear her name, I'm like, no, that's a Sarah Palin pick. No.
Yeah.
They're beautiful, beautiful women and they are accomplished. They are different, yes, but they're cut from the same cloth.
Well, so there's positive attributes and there's negative ones. And the negative one with Sarah Palin was she never developed as a candidate and as a public figure. She stayed in this sort of mama bear caricature. Mm-hmm. And there was opportunity to develop. There was opportunity to put people around you that could help you develop sort of intellectually and philosophically and thus politically. And it just never happened. And Kristi Noem is starting to give me that vibe. I mean, I get the initial Palin characterizations, good-looking mom. You know,
and shoot a rifle and a double-barrel shotgun and don't mess with my children.
Yeah,
and I love that because I feel like I have a little bit of that in me as a mom, too. But
That's all great, but it's that other piece, that missing piece. I don't think that makes she makes any sense for Trump as a VP, no. This probably doesn't aid the effort. But you know, these are strange times. As you've probably seen reported, RFK Jr. The top picks for RFK Jr. for his running mate are Jesse the Body Ventura and Aaron Rodgers. And he's supposed to announce his running mate on the 26th.
Right, in Oakland, California, and that is where Aaron Rodgers played college football.
Well, he played at Berkeley.
Well, but I mean, I'm saying
played,
in
no,
that,
he played at Cal.
No, he played at Cal.
Yeah, he played at Cal, that's right.
So I'm just saying that that's, I mean, is that saying
yeah,
something
he played
right
Cal,
there?
Yeah, he played at Cal Berkeley.
Thank
right,
you.
Yeah.
So I'm right and you're wrong. This mark that down.
Well, no,
that's the
I said he played at Berkeley, Cal Berkeley. That's Cal, yeah.
But I'm just saying, I wonder if that has, you know, something to do with it. But I'd much rather have him choose. Well, I don't care. The lines have been erased, so do what you want to do. And
so,
if the people want to vote for him, vote for him.
So he'll get Sundays off because he has to play quarterback for the Jets, right?
Exactly.
If he's the running mate.
Exactly.
Jesse the Body Ventura, Feather Boa is coming back. Well, the experience in Minneapolis did not in Minneapolis did not dissuade RFK Jr. I mean, Jesse the Body Ventura turned out to be, you know, a disaster as a governor. I mean, mm-hmm. He came in on this populist appeal, but he was a goof. So
what are we doing here in Aaron Rodgers? I mean,
no, but I mean, with that,
you got political with, you know, the vaccine mandates, but.
Well, this is the point, I guess, we're at a place where it's, you know, just pick sports stars and pop stars and actors and actresses. And I mean, sort of the substance of the person doesn't much matter.
Remember when Ditka was going to be running for senator when Jack Ryan had a dropout?
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea of people coming from notoriety in one space and entering politics, hardly new. John Glenn.
President Trump.
Bill Bradley. It's to sports specifically, too. So, I mean, there's nothing new about that. But sort of the elevation of people from, like, completely offstage left to national office, that gets a little bit more unusual.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Doug in Oswego, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, yeah. Hey, the pitcher surgery that you referred to, that would be called an adidectomy.
Hi-o. Thank you. Nick, Northwest Side.
Yeah, thank you very much. I was telling your screener that I was just thinking to myself about the earlier caller this morning who talked about what's our obligation, all these people coming in. Well, what's the obligation of my government when I tried three times through the welfare? I'm on Social Security, by the way. I worked my whole life, never been a welfare or an employment comp. I got some problems with my teeth that accumulated over the years with fillings, some teeth pulled out, some crowned. I got a one root canal tooth where the gum is discolored now.
All right.
And what I need to know is I qualified a long time ago for the right free permit for public transportation. And that they don't just, you know, give it to you. You have to go in, fill out forms, they check your.
No, of course. They don't just hand those things out. Oh, no, the government? Yeah. No, the oversight. The
accountability, they don't.
Of course.
No, they don't. I had to go to the old state of Illinois building.
Okay.
West of the county bill. But what?
So
can you give me some advice on maybe a GoFundMe account or something? Since I'm serious, you know, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but you have more experience with this, obviously, than I do, because you got all these people calling and you deal with all these people. Maybe a GoFundMe account so that some experienced dentist can analyze my teeth and say, well, estimate, I have to pull all his teeth out or the ones that are left. And then, to see what they got to do.
Direct message.
I mean, you know, I got to do something because the discoloration of the gum, I don't know if it's just bad circulation. I don't know.
For that one, Nick, you better get that checked out.
Thanks for the call, Nick. I did not go to dental school, so I'm not sure how much I can help there. But
call Dr. Joe Favia.
Run for governor and then get to deal with Smile Texas.
Lots of text messages. Dan and Amy, Christine Ohm's breast augmentation could be a pay-per-view event. Should I go here? Christine Ohm reminds me of Barbie Benton.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
Text from the Amish texture. Didn't that politician transfer portal work for Mitt Romney? It did. It's a good example.
Yeah.
That's a good example. See? Mm. See? I mean, right? He can. He's in Michigan one day, right. Massachusetts the next day, Utah.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Just move him around.
Text message, Amy, you're jealous. Governor Noem is a stunning beauty and a very smart woman.
I'm
not jealous. I respect her.
She's okay. But
I think she's beautiful.
Great. We'll write her
stunning.
A letter. To Kara Smile, Texas.
I'll DM her on Twitter, okay.
Ralph and Rantoul.
I think there's a lot of opportunity here. I think that a couple in my mind, I'm thinking Dick Cheney. He could do a spot for artificial hearts because his first one wasn't human enough. And so the robot that they put in his chest was an attempt to humanize him. And I'm thinking also we could go local. Don't just think national, think local. Who's the alderman that talked about what was his famous quote? I think he owns Ann Sather's talking about
being up somebody's butt every day.
Yeah,
the Ricketts's.
He could be a spokesman for colonoscopies.
Yeah, like hemorrhoid cream or something.
That's not colonoscopies really up your butt, Dan.
No, it's true.
Hemorrhoid cream is just a pretender.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't want to split
just
hairs
a Band-Aid.
With you, Ralph. Yeah, thanks for the call. But no, it's true. I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of endorsement opportunities that could be attended to moving around public offices. Yeah. And since, I mean, especially in Illinois, Ralph brings up a good point. Since we don't really much care who's in office in Illinois, why not have some fun with it and just move them around, see what happens?
Ooh, we got a call from within the state of South Dakota. Dun, dun, dun.
Marianne in Sioux Falls.
Hey, good morning. I am, it's cringeworthy what she did. She's running around doing ads saying, come to South Dakota, come to Sioux Falls, come wherever. And then she goes out of state to get her procedures done. We have a lot of good professionals there that could have done the job, but terrible, terrible. See, it reminds me of Palin.
What is the prevailing attitude about Noem these days up there?
People like her. Probably not as much as DeSantis. Better than some of the other governors. We do like her, but she's okay. Let's put it that way. Good through COVID.
Yeah, COVID, she shined. I mean, she was on an island on her own for a while.
What about the report? I mean, I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to go gossip girl here, but there have been public reports that would be problematic. I mean, this New York Post covered the story about her marriage. What do you think about that?
Well, you're hearing stuff just like everybody else. You know, people live their own lives there, and, you know, the government doesn't get in between us as much. So, you know, yeah, there is gossip about it. I think it just makes her look bad, you know, to go out of state. I mean, think about if you're a dental professional in the state. Really? It's bad.
Thanks for the call, Marianne. Yeah, so there you go. There's the straight dope from Sioux Falls. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender, Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. To ban or not to ban TikTok? That was the debate in the House yesterday, and the House came decidedly down on the side of banning or forcing TikTok to divest from its parent company, ByteDance, to be more specific. But the upshot is taking TikTok down the road to banishment in huge bipartisan support for that proposition. Now it will be taken up in the Senate. That's a question mark because Pagliacci Schumer is his enthusiasm for taking this up has been a bit muted, but there's going to be a lot of pressure to at least have a floor vote on. So we'll see. You know, the problem with this issue in part is you're, at least as I'm thinking about it,
right,
I'm having to make a decision about this and whether I think this is a good idea while leaning on people I do not trust to tell me about information that they have access to that I don't.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
So, for example, the intelligence community is in part driving this moment to banish TikTok.
Yeah, because they don't want the Chinese to spy on us and to have our information.
Allegedly, that's part of it.
Right.
But then on the other side, even though you have people that I'm otherwise inclined to give the benefit of the doubt to, like Rand Paul or Tom Massey, I mean, you have Chi-Com propaganda and bought and paid for lobbyists and politicians spewing said propaganda about how what ByteDance's relationship is with the Chinese Communist Party and how that influences their operation of TikTok. So, you know, I mean, I don't want to overstate the case because I despise when people do that. There's no need to. Chinese Communist Party, America's deep state. Who less deserves the benefit of the doubt? I guess you have to ask it in a negative way. At least that's my thinking on it.
Well, it's just weird because some people see TikTok as the dumbing down of society because kids are addicted to TikTok. And in China, kids can't use TikTok from 10 o'clock at night until 6 in the morning. So yeah, what do they know that we don't know?
Yeah, the content is different. We've had a number of extended pieces on this. We've also had documentaries about Facebook and other social media. I mean, the idea that TikTok is the sole source of the dumbing down of America, well, that's obviously absurd.
Right, because if they banned TikTok, then what would happen? Everyone would go back to Facebook. Maybe the kids would, because kids don't do Facebook. But well, I'll tell you this issue. I was with a bunch of kids yesterday, and they were, is it true they're going to ban TikTok? I'm like, the House voted to, and now it goes to the Senate if they're going to even take it up. But you, do your research. Check it out. If that's important to you, then look it up and read.
Yeah.
Learn something. Become part of the political process.
Okay. Debate on the floor. Here's probably a good encapsulation of the two positions. First, you'll hear from Wisconsin Rep. Mike Gallagher, who is the chief sponsor of this. He's the head of the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. He is a proponent. Obviously, he's the chief sponsor.
Thank you. TikTok is a threat to our national security because it is owned by ByteDance, which does the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. We know this because ByteDance leadership says so and because Chinese law requires it. This bill, therefore, forces TikTok to break up with the Chinese Communist Party. It does not apply to American companies. It only applies to companies subject to the control of foreign adversaries defined by Congress. It says nothing about election interference and cannot be turned against any American social media platform. It does not impact websites in general. The only impacted sites are those associated with foreign adversary apps, such as TikTok.com. It can never be used to penalize individuals. The text explicitly prohibits that, and it cannot be used to censor speech. It takes no position at all on the content of speech, only foreign adversary control. Foreign adversary control of what is becoming the dominant news platform for Americans under 30. This is a common sense measure to protect our national security. I urge my colleagues to support this critical bipartisan legislation.
All right, so there's the pro side. Here's the con side, as represented by Tom Massey, the Republican libertarian congressman from Kentucky.
The bill that's offered here today, even though I know it's offered genuinely, it could also be named the Facebook Protection and Enhancement Act, because it's not the American people who are going to benefit most from this. It will be Facebook. Their stock is going to go up if this bill should pass the Senate. Now, what are some ways that we could improve this bill? Well, it should at least have a sunset. I mean, that's the only reason we're able to debate whether FISA should have warrants in it, because it sunsets. And what have we observed? FISA's been abused. That's my concern with this TikTok ban. It will be abused. If it's just banning TikTok and ByteDance and copies of that, why does it need to be 13 pages long? And I know they say it doesn't ban it. It forces divestiture of the company. This sounds like when American companies try to do business in third world countries and a dictator says, well, you can do business here. You just got to give me your company. And now you can continue to do business. We wouldn't let another country take over Ford Motor Company for selling Ford cars in their country. Yet that's what we're wanting to do here. And again, you know, this is a cure that is worse than the disease. Who's going to be prosecuted by this bill? Is it ByteDance or TikTok? Will they be taken to court? No. I mean, they're the target of this, but how do you elicit or effect a ban on them? By prosecuting Americans. The only way you can ban TikTok and the other companies from being here is to say what this bill says, which is we will bring civil action, the government will bring a civil action suit against you if you so much as host them here. If you have an app store that allows them to be here, you are an American or an American company, and you will be the target of this bill. Those are the only people who can be pursued under this bill. And I know it's in order to go after TikTok, or so they say. Well, I would just close by saying that, you know, we're sitting here with phones made in China. We're wearing suits made in China. We drove cars here with chips that are made in China. And they're our foreign adversary. And by golly, we're going to do something about it. What are we going to do? We're going to tell Americans they can't put a piece of software on their computer. They can't go to certain websites that the president designates. So I urge my colleagues to oppose this well-intentioned bill because it will have bad consequences, and I yield back the balance of my time.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I think those are fairly good summaries of the positions on the two sides. So where do you come down? Brian in St. John, Indiana.
I stand with Representative Massey. Government overreach, and you know there's something in it for them at the end of the day. When are we supposed to trust the government? That's all I got. Bye.
All right, thanks for the call.
A lot of text messages on this. Kids will not turn to Facebook if TikTok is banned. That's a silly Trump talking point. They turn to Instagram. And then somebody else texted in.
Well, what is, I mean,
it's all.
Yeah, I understand, but I know this is what, just so people have in case they haven't heard it, this is what Trump said on CNBC about this very issue.
The thing I don't like is that without TikTok, you can make Facebook bigger. And I consider Facebook to be an enemy of the people, along with a lot of the media. What Facebook did with lockboxes, with the $500 million Zuckerbucks lockboxes that he put in, I mean, I consider illegal. But, they put people in jail when they spend more than $5,600 in a campaign. They go to jail if they're $200. Look at Dinesh D'Souza.
Right.
They put him in jail over a couple of hundred bucks. And yet here's a guy spends $500 million and he doesn't go to jail.
And to that texter, the people won't turn to Facebook, they'll turn to Instagram. Who owns Instagram?
Facebook.
Right.
Right.
So that's what, I mean, let's get up to speed here, number one. Number two, that's the point that Trump is making is it may be very personal in nature to him because of Zuckerberg's election interference in 2020. And but I mean, all these social media companies are left, those that are American based and those that are not, and the ones that we're talking about now, like TikTok. So I'm not sure the decision on TikTok should be predicated on whether or not it makes Facebook and its various platforms stronger. But
I'm into freedom of speech and expression, so I wouldn't ban TikTok. I don't think that's going to. I mean, what is that? Well, they're trying to bully them to sell part of their company to an American-owned company so that they won't spy on us anymore. I don't know. I don't see that happening.
Don't see which happening.
That the Chinese are going to give up their portion of TikTok or sell any part of their business to an American-owned company.
Yeah, I would suspect that they wouldn't unless they could do it, unless they could sort of wire it up where they still had some backdoor access. Right, because here's the rub. TikTok's algorithms are controlled by ByteDance engineers in China who answer to the Chinese Communist Party. And the Chinese Communist Party treats those algorithms as basically a state secret. So the idea that the Chinese communists are going to turn over something they consider a state secret in pursuit of global dominance over TikTok access to the American market. I don't know. But I mean, that is a possibility. I mean, there are arguments both ways on this, but the idea that TikTok could still operate under American control, that is a prospect. That this does not ban TikTok out of hand. It does provide a path. And by the way, there have been these sorts of arrangements before. This happened actually to the Grindr app, that gay dating app.
Oh yeah.
There was a divestiture. And American investors bought it, and it was allowed to continue. And because it was otherwise Chinese communist controlled. Did you know that? Most people didn't. So there's precedent for this sort of arrangement. The question is it appropriate in this case based on the relative merits of the competing arguments? Tony in Riverside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. I laugh because they claim it's because they are afraid of China gathering all of our information. Yet we had a Chinese balloon that went from coast to coast. I mean, that's ridiculous. They have our information.
Well, thanks for the call, Tony. Not to mention the our former DNI, Jim Clap On, Clap Off, Clap On, Clap Off, Clap On, Clap Off, Jim Clapper. He lied to Congress about the metadata collection program that was going on under Obama. Collecting information, Americans' conversations of Americans. So there's no question, but then you have to pull back and say, yeah, we have a compromised administration when it comes to China, in part because of Biden's Inc.'s financial relationships with Chinese communists. That alone presents a conflict of interest and potentially a compromising situation, as we have, as has been detailed, quite extensively. And you have the sort of fecklessness with regard to our national security between spy balloons and tens of thousands of military-aged Chinese nationals walking into our country on the southern border. So, oh, yeah, these are people of serious, sort of like what Massey was saying. And then with respect to a trade policy and rare minerals from China and microchips from China and all the products we buy that are Chinese-made. And so... But that is a little bit different than the propaganda portal. And as much skepticism that we should rightly have based on their conduct for these deep state agencies and their motivations. And a lot of these politicians, too, and their motivations. You know, I mean, if you have to come down on one side, I think you still have to sort of hold your nose and come down on the side of the American government and not the Chinese one. This is not a happy occurrence, as you can tell from my sigh.
No.
The provision in the legislation, there also is this, and this is debated, the interpretation of it, allows the president to make unilateral determinations about whether other apps, quote, present a significant threat to national security of the United States. So, you know, if there is any sort of open-ended provisions or provisions that could be interpreted in an open-ended fashion by a future administration, and that's, you know, almost always the case if there's a desire to do that. And this is from a Newsweek op-ed by Michael Tracy, who's an independent journalist. Then, you know, that presents another complication about the expanse of the expansion of state power and presidential power we're giving here in an era where you see our government routinely making decisions about where the law applies based on political considerations and not legal ones. So it's a real tough call. The other part of this, too, is
what?
It's this threat it presents and our kids and so on and so forth. Well, you know, this is also a way for politicians and the people to absolve themselves of responsibility. Responsibility for the platforms they use, the content they consume, abdicate responsibility for their kids and the oversight of their kids and the devices they use and the platforms they use and the content they consume. I mean, that's the whole thing that really makes it adds another layer of complication for me, is this is just more of like innocent bystander Americanism, which I think is really tearing at the fabric of our country more so than any digital platform. Jordan and Antioch, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. So there's a lot here, and you just hit on a lot of it, Dan. And I hate the fact that we're in a position where we have to make a decision and really think about and chew on which one is more corrupt, China or our own government. And I'd like to hear an argument as to – I understand the reasoning behind it, but I don't understand the execution of it. Meaning, you want to ban a company and dismantle a company that's doing exactly what the American data companies are doing already, right? I get in my truck, I start my truck, it tells me it takes me 25 minutes to get home. It doesn't know I'm going home. It's just built habits and sends all that. Ask the people at January 6th that were just there on the mall and ended up getting arrested because they tracked their metadata. And the other thing about that is, if you're worried about the kids, you're worried about the kids and the content, then be a parent and don't let them have it.
Well, that's where I was going.
That argument. Mm-hmm. I have a 17-year-old that's never had TikTok, never had Facebook, never had Instagram.
Wow.
And then people are like, oh, how does he get through the day? Well, he goes to school, he comes home, he does his things, he doesn't want to have a sex change, he doesn't want to have any of that crap because you have to be a parent.
It's good to know.
Right? Yeah. Doesn't want a tattoo.
It makes you sound like a bully or I hate that term, the helicopter. But, yeah, I check his phone. That's my job. I'm his dad. I'm supposed to know what's going on in his life. So if you're worried that kids are seeing – we're just sitting at a meeting, bunch of garbage, man, and the guys are on TikTok watching a video of – I'm not even – it was horrible. Like I'm like, that's a perfectly good reason why TikTok shouldn't be there. But on the other hand, I have the option to not look at it. Right?
Yeah, and on the
scantily clad high school girls.
Thanks for the culture. And on the other hand, you can get the same video or videos like it on every other platform.
True,
so I mean, the other thing about this too that's rather ironic if you work the logic a bit. So the Wall Street Journal opined on this. ByteDance runs a version of TikTok in China called Douyin, which we know. The company could similarly silo off and sell its U.S. TikTok business. This shouldn't be difficult since TikTok claims American user data is housed on servers overseen by Oracle. Yeah, the data is like a false issue because the data is I mean, so commoditized now. The idea that your privacy is protected and there are great guardians of your private data is laughable. Anybody who believes that is, you know, still believes in Santa Claus. But the idea here is, what we talked about at the outset. So the Chinese communists allow for different content to run through the Chinese version of TikTok as opposed to the American one. And this has been subject of 60 Minutes exposés and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that they're trying to are pumping jingoistic content through the Chinese version of the app, and they're pumping a lot of anti-American content through the American version of the app. I mean, remember most famously, and this is recent, all these people on TikTok talking about how Osama bin Laden had a point and making absurd rationalizations for 9/11. But so our position is, and we're using this as a basis to ban. So our position is that we should trust government central planners to moderate content rather than a free marketplace of idea exchange, right? Aren't we saying that China is preventing content and so we should be preventing content? Since China is manipulating content on both sides, we should eliminate the content on the one side so as to not allowing them to manipulate it, rather than saying on the side where China is pushing anti-American content, but it's still sort of a open platform. It's a free marketplace. I could go put a TikTok video up right now that says America's great and it would post. We're also sort of saying we don't believe really in a free marketplace of ideas. And so we have to ban the propagandists rather than be more persuasive than the propagandists with our own content. Anyway, lots of thoughts here.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Let's get right to him. Martin Kulldorff is a former professor of medicine at Harvard University. Former, emphasis. And Mass General Brigham Mass General Brigham Hospital and founding fellow of the Academy for Science and Freedom. And, of course, you remember we've had Martin Kulldorff on the show many times over the last several years during COVID. And he, along with Jay Bhattacharya and Sunetra Gupta and Scott Atlas and a handful of others, were the nucleus of the Great Barrington Declaration and essentially represented the side that brought appropriate scientific skepticism to the pronouncements that were coming from the government. And if you remember, and you can go back and look at the permanent record, this was not ideological from the Great Barrington Declaration folks as compared to the government. It was not anti-vax. It was measured and textured and humble. Here's what we don't know. Here's what we think. Here's how we should try to get to what we don't know. I mean, so the heroes in these stories, in the story of COVID, are the people that were the most vilified and turned out to be, of course, the most correct. And it's professionals in the space that risked their professional careers, their livelihoods, at the time, in the moment, not after they retired, not after they were collecting a pension, Francis Collins, to tell the truth because lives and livelihoods and liberties were at stake. And by the way, just as a quick aside before we get to Martin Kulldorff, because I so love this piece that Cheryl Atkinson did on her most recent edition of Full Measure. Mm-hmm. She talked to whistleblowers. And what it entails to be a whistleblower. And these epidemiologists that I just described, including the one we're going to speak to, I mean, they were effectively whistleblowers.
Right.
And we're going to talk a little bit later about a Boeing whistleblower who's no longer with us. But Lauren Reed, you may not remember her name. She was the Acorn whistleblower. She was the whistleblower who said during the Obama years, Acorn was embezzling all the millions of dollars in federal funds it had received to do, you know, political field work for the Democrat Party. But whatever, it was illegitimately funded. But that's not the issue. The issue was they were stealing the money. They were not using the federal taxpayer dollars under the terms of the grant they received. But listen to what she says about the state of whistleblowing in America today and what it means to be a whistleblower. This is just an important cultural commentary by Lauren Reed.
What would you say is the state of whistleblowing in America today?
People are calling themselves whistleblowers that are not. There's a simple rule for whistleblowing. You blew the whistle when something was at stake. That is when you blow the whistle. Not after your 401 is secure, your job is secure, and your kid has been accepted to whatever school you've slotted for them. Because it doesn't make what you're saying less true, but it does not make you a whistleblower.
And what is the sort of a takeaway message or the thing that you would want people to know about the whole idea of whistleblowing?
So people think that the defenders of democracy wear uniforms. That's absolutely true. But the ultimate defenders of democracy are those who are willing to tell the truth and withstand the cost. And there is no such thing as telling the truth and paying no cost.
There's no such thing as telling the truth and paying no cost. Love that. Martin Kulldorff, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote this piece recently in the City Journal about your travails over the last 4 years, starting with the fact that you're a former professor of medicine at Harvard. So tell us what happened.
Well, they were not very happy when I wrote the Great Plankton Declaration with J. Bhattacharya at Stanford and Sunetha Gupta at Oxford. But then eventually the disagreement was about infection-acquired immunity. We have known for 2,500 years since the Athenian plague in 430, if you have recovered from a disease, an infectious disease, then you have immunity. Somehow during the pandemic, that was questioned. There was a memorandum in the Lancet, which used to be a leading medical journal, where Harvard professors and others questioning the COVID-acquired immunity. So they had these mandates on the vaccines, even for people who didn't need it, who had superior immunity. And I argue that hospitals should hire nurses and others with prior immunity, because they are the least likely to sort of infect others. But instead, they were firing people with who had, like, they fired nurses who had to take care of COVID patients during 2020, and then they got sick in COVID. They were home for a while and they got back. And then the bureaucrats, the hospital bureaucrats, they fired them because they hadn't gotten the vaccine, even though they already had better immunity. And I never took care of COVID patients, but I was one of the people fired. And many professors got exemptions, but I requested exemptions, but did not get it, even though I had an immune deficiency, a genetic immune deficiency called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency.
So you were fired for not getting vaxxed?
Yes, and mm-hmm. They could have kept me if they wanted to, but they didn't want me there. They could have also hired me afterwards, hired me back, but they explicitly said I didn't want to do that.
Well, yeah, isn't that interesting, right? Because Lloyd Austin won't hire people in the armed services that he fired. He won't hire them back. There's actually a lawsuit that's been filed, a religious discrimination lawsuit that's been filed by a Hollywood actor that could be precedential in terms of the major studios, but it's the same thing. They don't want you back because to take you back would be to,
that they were wrong, right?
Well, I think in their minds that's what it would be, and it also sends a message that if you disobey us, that there is a path back, and we want the message to be you cannot disobey us.
Yeah.
Well, have you thought about suing Harvard?
Well, I'm not that kind of person who sort of I prefer to just tell people what happened and then fight for freedom of speech and academic freedom. So maybe I will, maybe I won't, but that's not on the top of my agenda. So.
Well, this article, I love this article, Harvard Tramples the Truth. It's at cityjournal.org. But in the article, you talked about how the harm that was done is going to last for decades. And just can you walk us through that?
Well, the lockdowns and school closures, that went against all the basic principles of public health. And one of those is that you can't just focus on one disease, COVID. So we have the lockdowns create a lot of collateral public health damage for cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and mental health, and so on. So, and of course, education. And that's something we're going to live with for a long time now. We know that the test scores for children has gone down in the U.S., unlike Sweden that didn't lock down the schools. So that's something we live with forever, because education is important. It's important for children to go to school. And it's not just the test scores. It's also their social development. So this is something that we now have to deal with decades. Same with cancer. There were less cancer screening and less cancer treatment. So somebody who will not die maybe 2 or 3 years from now instead of living another 10, 15 years, because getting your medical treatment for cancer is important. If you don't get it, then you won't live as long. So, and that's just cancer. There's so many other parts of medicine. So these lockdowns were enormously damaging on public health in general, and of course as well on education and the economy.
And just recalling the media's folding in with the COVIDian state edicts. At the time, you wrote op-eds about Sweden and what Sweden was doing when it came through, when it came to K-12 schools and not shutting them down, and you couldn't get published anywhere. You couldn't get published, at least not in the English-speaking world, right?
Yeah, so I had op-eds in Sweden, the major newspapers there. I'm a native of Sweden, defending the Swedish strategy. But in the U.S., I was not able to publish anything in the spring or summer of 2020, except in August, I was finally able to publish an op-ed in against the school closure, GNN, but that was seen in Espanol. I know how to write Spanish. Seen in English, didn't want to publish it.
That is so weird. And not one person in Sweden ages 1 to 15 died from COVID.
Yeah, so they kept the schools and daycare open for among 1.8 million children that spring. Not a single child died, and there was only a few hospitalizations. And the teachers were at no higher risk than other professions. So we knew that early in the summer of 2020. But then New England Journal of Medicine published a paper by a couple of Harvard professors discussing school closures, and I didn't even mention Sweden and the positive results there. So that's like doing a trial of a new drug, and then you don't even have a placebo control group to compare with. That's not how you find the truth.
Another example about how so much of this was an exercise in the compulsory unification of opinion, to borrow from Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson. Your experience on the COVID vaccine working group and how you were bounced from that working group. This is the CDC's COVID vaccine working group, if I'm recalling correctly. You were bounced from that working group because you were too pro-vaccine.
Yes, I'm probably the only one who's been fired by CDC for being too pro-vaccine. But so there were the two mRNA vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and then there was a third one, Johnson & Johnson, but it's not an mRNA vaccine. And there were some reports of blood clots in young women. So CDC decided to take a pause on it. And that was reasonable for young women, but not for older people there where there had been no such reports. And they're the one who really needed it because it's the older people who were dying from COVID. So I objected to the pause of this for older people because it was a non-mRNA vaccine that was only one dose. So it was important for reaching, for example, hard-to-reach people like in rural areas or like homeless people. But they did not like that I argued against the official CDC position. So they fired me from the committee. But 4 days later, they actually implemented what I suggested. So that's not effective, but I was removed from the CDC committee for that.
Removed from the CDC working group for being too pro-vaccine. Oh, right. It's all about the unification of opinion. Yeah. The other thing I wanted you to discuss from, you know, your background as an epidemiologist is why you argue that the trials for the vaccines were improperly or poorly designed.
So they were randomized, which is important for all drug and vaccine trials, but they didn't have the right outcome. So they looked at symptomatic COVID disease and showed that there was 95% efficacy for short-term symptomatic infections. But that's not what we care about. Our concern is not that somebody will be home for a few days in bed sick. We're concerned about people not dying or being hospitalized. And they didn't design it for that because they recruited young and middle-aged adults who mostly survive whether they have the placebo or the vaccine. So they should have recruited more people in the 70s and 80s and 90s in order to determine if this actually reduces mortality. And they didn't do that. And then they ended the trials very early instead of continuing them to look at long-term efficacy and side effects. So these were not well-designed trials for giving us the information we need about these vaccines. And, of course, the boost is even worse because they didn't even have randomized trials.
Your colleague, Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, says that the next virus, they'll absolutely do a lockdown again. Do you, you know, the they being the COVIDians who locked down America, do you agree with him that that's their attitude?
I think that they're going to try to do that. But unlike 4 years ago, there's now a very strong organized opposition against it. So 4 years, there were a lot of people speaking out, but they couldn't get heard. They were silenced, and everybody was sort of on their own. But now there's an organized effort that ended these lockdowns. They would have continued longer if there wasn't. And I think next time around, that's already sort of an established people are already on the ball about this thing. So I don't think they will succeed if they try again.
He is Martin Caldor, former professor of medicine at Harvard and Mass General Brigham Hospital, founding fellow of the Academy for Science and Freedom. Professor Caldor, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Yep, always a pleasure. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What is going on with air travel in this country? There seem to be a rash of mishaps of late, and obviously mishaps when you're talking about airplanes is a dicey business.
Well, yeah, United Airlines had 5 incidents in less than a week, all with Boeings, different, you know, makes and models. But and then you had the Alaska Airlines flight, the panel flew off, the tires are falling off. Don't feel good about traveling right now.
Hey, boss. Your tire just rolled off. It's rolling down the runway behind.
Crashed
you.
Into a parked car. They're lucky it didn't kill somebody.
And this is against the backdrop of this government whistleblower retaliation suit that former Boeing safety engineer John Burnett was pursuing. He was providing a deposition in Charleston, South Carolina, though he's based in Louisville. And he was set to go back for day three of the deposition in the case when he didn't show up. And attorneys reached out to the hotel where he was staying to check on him. And the staff at the hotel found him dead of a gunshot wound in his truck in the parking lot.
And they're saying it's suicide, but I'm not buying that. Well, why would you commit suicide during the middle of your deposition? You don't do that. Who does that? It's just very bizarre to me.
It is strange, and the lawyers sort of said as much, although his brother, Rodney Barnett, told the Associated Press that his brother John was suffering from PTSD and anxiety attacks as a result of being subjected to the hostile work environment at Boeing, which we believe led to his death. So that's the family's perspective. So they knew maybe things weren't what they seemed with John, although, again, the attorneys told Time magazine he was in very good spirits and really looking forward to putting this phase of his life behind him and moving on. We didn't see any indication he would take his own life. No one can believe it. But it seemed like his brother sort of did believe it. That was the that was reporting by Clive Irving over at the Daily Beast. And we'll get to him in a second for more on this. But here was a sum of what John Barnett had provided in public testimony, because since his retirement from Boeing in 2017, he had been very public about his criticism of Boeing cutting corners when it came to safety.
One, this is not a 737 problem. It's a Boeing problem. And I know the FAA's gone in and they've done due diligence and inspections to assure that the door plugs of the 737 are installed properly and the fasteners are torqued properly. But my concern is, what's the rest of the airplane? What's the rest of the condition of the airplane? And the reason my concern for that is, back in 2012, Boeing started removing inspection operations off their jobs. So it left the mechanics to buy off their own work. So what we're seeing with the door plug blowout is what I've seen with the rest of the airplane, as far as jobs not being completed properly, inspection of steps being removed, issues being ignored. My concerns are with the 737 and the 787, because those programs have really embraced the theory that quality is overhead and non-value added. So those two programs have really put a strong effort into removing quality from the process. When I first started working at Charleston, I was in charge with pushing back defects to our suppliers. And what that meant was I'd take a group of inspectors and actually go to the supplier and inspect their product before they sent it in. Well, I'd taken a team of four inspectors to Spirit AeroSystems to inspect the 41 section before they sent it to Charleston. And we found 300 defects. Some of them were significant that needed engineering intervention. When I returned to Charleston, my senior manager told me that we had found too many defects and he was going to take the next trip. So the next trip he went on, he took two of my inspectors. And when they got back, they were given accolades for only finding 50 defects. So I pulled that inspector aside and I said, did Spirit really clean up their act that quick? That don't sound right. And she was mad. She said, no. Said the two inspectors were given 2 hours to inspect the whole 41 section and they were kicked off the airplane.
So obviously what he's arguing there is it's a culture problem, as you heard him say at the outset of that clip. For more on this, Clive Irving is a columnist for the Daily Beast, senior consulting editor at Condé Nast Traveler, specializing in aviation. He's also the author of Jumbo, The Making of the Boeing 747. And most recently, The Last Queen, Elizabeth II's 70-year reign, a 70-year battle to save the House of Windsor, that is. The Last Queen and Jumbo, The Making of Boeing 747. Clive Irving, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, and it's a very, very sad commentary about John Barnett, because one of the ironies of the situation is that he didn't really need to say anything else, because the case he made has been amply proved by all the reporting of the problems at the 787 plant in North Charleston. But there's a much larger issue here, which is that when I wrote the book about the creation of the 747, that was 20 years ago, I was lucky enough to interview all the great engineers who had created the jet age from 1959 onward. This was a cadre of exceptional men, and they were responsible for the fact that the whole world regarded Boeing as peerless, that in fact the word Boeing became a synonym for any jet. People would all around the world would look up in the sky and say, Boeing. And now we've got to this wretched situation where the company's standing has been in the 4 years that this man, Dave Calhoun, has been running it. The company has been absolutely plagued by one crisis after another, all involving quality. And what does this man say as an explanation of what's going on? He uses this terrible management speak phrase, quality escape. What's escaped in Boeing is any attention to the standing and the stature of one of the world's, well, one of this nation's greatest companies, with one of the most astonishing technical achievements over the last 50 years. And it's now got to a situation where Calhoun says it's unlikely that they'll create any new plane in this decade, and that means that it would probably be until 2035 or 2040 before they could produce a single new one. So what does that do to the commercial standing of the company? It means that they basically surrendered the future to their great competitor, Airbus. So on the simple basis of making money in the long term, he's failed, and in the simple basis of destroying the reputation of the company in the short term, he's certainly succeeded.
Well, is part of it as the cultural shift a reflection of the shift in revenue streams? So my understanding is that the Defense Space and Security unit at Boeing has overtaken commercial airplanes as the largest revenue source. So maybe there is.
Is that
is that an important part of the story?
Well, I think psychologically for these men who at the top of the company whose interest is really short term and returning the greatest amount of money to the shareholders themselves that they can, that's absolutely true. So what you're really describing is an attitude of low priority. But I mean, it's one thing to take a spreadsheet view of the whole Boeing books and decide that the real money is in the defense and aerospace section. Mind you, they're just as incompetent in those divisions as they are in the commercial aircraft division, because they have constant, in the military division, they have constant overruns. They break the budgets, and the same is true in aerospace. That Elon Musk's company is the only one really out there that delivers on time and on budget. And it used to be that Boeing was as prominent in the aerospace business as it was in the in the space business as it was in the aerospace business, and they're not. They've lost their reputation there too. So it's a very worrying situation. John Barnett case, which is obviously very tragic, just reflects the atmosphere that confronts anyone who wanted to raise a red flag in what was going on in the plants. And people I've talked to in Seattle, veterans say that Barnett's the most tragic and egregious example of what they do. What they do is, when someone pops up and says, I'm concerned about this, they immediately start burying them in threats of litigation. And they can bury somebody with very few personal resources in very expensive litigation for a very long time. So that creates an intimidating situation inside the company. Moreover, they're very arrogant. At this moment, with the inquiry going on about the blown-out door, where it's astonishing that four bolts that were supposed to be holding the door in place were left out. During the course of that inquiry now, they're refusing to hand over details to the National Transportation Safety Board.
Yeah, but why is Boeing cutting corners when they know that they're putting lives at risk? I mean, look at the 737 MAX 9 and those two crashes. I mean, why would they do that?
Well, yes. I mean, that's how do you answer that question? Well, they're showing what they've done is stripped away layers. As John Barnett was saying, they took people off the lines whose job it was to carry out the last stage of inspection. So when the plane went out the door, everybody building the plane had confidence that they were sending a plane out that was entirely safe. And Barnett himself said that he never felt that any plane that went out of the door in North Charleston was entirely safe. You hear engineers from the 737 MAX program, a very plagued program, saying they would never themselves fly on a 737 MAX. I mean, you can't get greater condemnation than that.
Is there anything you said that Barnett was already said everything he had to say, really, but I mean, just because of the surprise of his suicide that didn't seem to be, I mean, maybe as again per your reporting and what his brother said, maybe there was some signs, but clearly not to the extent that anybody believed that would occur. Was there anything else do you know that he had left to say about Boeing that would have been particularly damaging that may cast the suicide in a different light?
Well, that's a good question, and obviously I don't have access to his depositions in the two days that he gave the story. But I don't see any. First of all, I can't think that there could be anything any more damning than he'd already said, and that we already know. That's the mystery. So, and I think it's impossible for us to understand the psychological situation that he was enduring.
Yeah. Well, so then on Boeing, I mean, Boeing is a supplier to a lot of commercial carriers. So I mean, what is your net from the reporting you've done going back two decades and what we know about what's happening at Boeing and what John Barnett said about what's happening in Boeing and the senior officials you talked to in Seattle? So what's our understanding of the safety of air travel, the safest form of transportation, you know, at present, certainly still.
Yeah, well, it's an extremely safe form of travel. And, of course, that's a result of decades of learning from crashes and creating aircraft now which can virtually fly themselves. And that brings me back to the 737 MAX, which is that early around when a guy called Jim McNerney was the chief executive officer of Boeing, and he was schooled in the very ruthless, cost-cutting philosophy of Jack Welch at General Electric, as Calhoun, the current CEO, was. There's this line of people that were recruited who had backgrounds from GE and their ruthless cost-cutting. They don't seem to understand that when you're cutting costs on producing refrigerators or other domestic appliances or anything that GE did, it doesn't put lives at risk. As soon as you start cost-cutting and manufacturing aircraft, of course, as we see now, it does put lives at risk. So what happened in the early part? The last modern plane that they created was 20 years ago, the 787, which in many ways was a brilliant technological breakthrough and one that is very safe, and until you find out what's going on in the production plant, then you begin to wonder whether it is that safe, because you have to make a division between the production standards of the company and the actual concept of the aircraft. And what Boeing is suffering now is unique, I think, among any aircraft manufacturers, is that it's on the factory floor. It's at the very last point which determines whether the plane, when it goes out behind the doors, is safe or not. It's at that point that the whole system is breaking down. So you've got a situation where from the moment McNerney took over, this regime of cutting costs wherever they could be cut was instigated. Also, McNerney was the guy who decided not to produce an all-new single-aisle jet to compete with Airbus's A320 and A321, because it was much better, easier for them to make money by just adding another extension to this 737 is a 1968 design. I talked to some of the people who designed it originally, and they were aghast at what was going on now. And a lot of the problems with the 737 are that they're trying to stretch a plane that had already been stretched too far. For example, the FAA has yet to certify the largest model of this is another story to come up, I think, is that the largest 737 will carry 220 to 240 people inside that very narrow fuselage, which was designed in the 1960s. When you walk, if you get into this thing, you'll feel a sense of a tunnel, and seats crammed together will give you a claustrophobic feeling. And so I started asking questions about whether they'd carried out the proper tests for cabin evacuation in crashes, because people are supposed to be able to get out of these planes under any circumstances, no matter how bad, in 90 seconds, which in fact did happen very recently in a crash of an Airbus A350. But I had serious doubts about looking at the layout of this plane. And by the way, that door that blew out, mm-hmm. that wasn't a door, was an emergency door that was put in that 737. If they stacked in this maximum number of seats, they had to have an extra door in it. So the largest model, the 10, which is still awaiting certification and won't probably get certification for a while yet, has to be fully tested on it, whether the people can get out of it. And I'm not at all sure that they have tested it in that way. So there's another thing to worry about in the future if that plane ever gets to airlines, which I wonder whether it will.
But you're saying that this is a problem that's unique. I mean, it's not a problem at Airbus, at least not that we know of. It's a problem that's unique to Boeing's culture at a particular point in the production line, and ideally this attention, including from John Barnett, will force Boeing to make the changes that are necessary to be up to snuff safety wise, right? I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah. Yes, it's become endemic now throughout every level of the production of these planes, clearly. And FAA supervision has been greatly increased, but I don't think sufficiently increased, because what you need is people right there rather than people checking paperwork about whether an inspection has been carried out. You actually need people. And I think the investigation of how that door blew out in the end will show a very bad and damning situation. And I don't see how this man Calhoun can survive in charge of this company any longer.
Clive Irving is columnist for the Daily Beast, senior consulting editor at Condé Nast Traveler, specializing in aviation. He's also the author of Jumbo, The Making of the Boeing 747, which we were talking about. And more recently, The Last Queen, Elizabeth II's 70-year battle to save the House of Windsor. Clive Irving, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back sometime. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So let's go back again to hear what Representative Mike Gallagher had to say. He is the chief sponsor of the legislation that would force TikTok to divest from ByteDance, its Chi-Com-controlled parent company, if it was going to continue to be available on smartphones in America. Here's the basis for it from the chief sponsor of the legislative measure.
Thank you. TikTok is a threat to our national security because it is owned by ByteDance, which does the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. We know this because ByteDance leadership says so and because Chinese law requires it. This bill therefore forces TikTok to break up with the Chinese Communist Party. It does not apply to American companies. It only applies to companies subject to the control of foreign adversaries defined by Congress. It says nothing about election interference and cannot be turned against any American social media platform. It does not impact websites in general. The only impacted sites are those associated with foreign adversary apps, such as TikTok.com. It can never be used to penalize individuals. The text explicitly prohibits that, and it cannot be used to censor speech. It takes no position at all on the content of speech, only foreign adversary control. Foreign adversary control of what is becoming the dominant news platform for Americans under 30. This is a common sense measure to protect our national security. I urge my colleagues to support this critical bipartisan legislation.
For the contra argument, Michael Tracy's independent journalist, writing at Newsweek, if the case for banning TikTok advanced by the intelligence community is so airtight and worthy of instant unanimous approval, they should disclose the supporting evidence. Otherwise, the public's only option is to credulously accept subjective, questionably motivated claims of unknown intelligence community operators who purport to assess a national security threat posed by communist-controlled teenage dance videos, before rashly ejecting up to 170 million American users from a top social media platform, partly based on evidence furnished in these secret Star Chamber proceedings. Why not declassify and release the relevant evidentiary material so the public can evaluate for themselves? Why should informed democratic deliberations on the subject be reserved for those with specially approved security clearances? For more on this topic and a few other legal matters, we're pleased to be joined again by Professor William Jacobson. He is clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School, the founder of LegalInsurrection.com and the president of the Legal Insurrection Foundation, also the Equal Protection Project. Professor Jacobson, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me back.
So are you persuaded by Mike Gallagher? Are you persuaded by Michael Tracy? Are you somewhere in between? Where do you come down on this?
Well, I'd say I probably agree with both, that there does seem to be a consensus that the parent company of TikTok, which is controlled by the Chinese government, has access to information it shouldn't have. But I do also think there's got to be more than just a consensus, because sometimes the consensus is wrong. So I think there's got to be some way, and if it's provided, you know, to people in Congress who have security clearances, but there's got to be some check there confirming that this is a security risk. This is not something that's new. It's not something that it's not a new allegation. It's not something that was just invented for this bill. For multiple years, there's been complaints about this. And so, yeah, I think there should be some evidence. I don't think we need to reveal to the public our secret sources if we have them. But I think, you know, the people voting on this in Congress should have, you know, access to that information, assuming that they've got the appropriate clearances. So I kind of agree with both. I think there should be some, you know, evidence that this is happening, which people have been claiming for years, not just recently. On the other hand, if it's true, then I think we should get the Chinese spy app off the phones of 170 million Americans. What are they doing with this information? So, yeah, I think I agree with both. But if it's true, then I think we need to prevent this information gathered on 170 million Americans from being available to the Chinese intelligence operations.
Yeah, but I mean, the question is, and then is anybody else doing something similar in kind to what TikTok is alleged to have to be doing, you know, Google and Facebook and other media platforms, social media platforms? And are there third-party vendors that are packaging this information and selling it? And does the government have access to it? And is there information of this sort that TikTok is allegedly collecting that's going back and forth between the government and social media companies for the purposes of censoring, monitoring, propagandizing to Americans? I don't hear those questions being pushed as much. And so while I guess I'll provide a little bit more benefit of the doubt to our intelligence agencies than the Chinese Communist Party, it doesn't mean that I don't have questions for what our government and our government's relationship with social media companies in this country are.
Well, that's all good and true. If there may be more questions, there may be more things that need to be looked at. But just because we can't solve all the problems doesn't mean we shouldn't solve any. And if it is true, if it's true that TikTok serves as a essentially spy app for the Chinese government, then I think we should address that problem. If there are other issues, which there certainly are, it was just in the paper 2 or 3 days ago about, automobile manufacturers putting software in vehicles that gets shared with insurance companies. And people, there's a lot more questions. I don't think this solves every problem. And I think there are bigger questions about social media. TikTok, which I won't put on my phone because I don't want purported to be a Chinese spyware on my phone. I'm not going to do it knowingly. Seems to be particularly addictive, seems to be the crack cocaine of social media. That's a whole different question that this bill doesn't address, which is, really a health concern for the country with social media in general. But TikTok appears to be the worst and most addictive of the social media apps, to the extent that when it was feared that this might end up in a quote unquote ban of TikTok, which it won't, Congress was flooded with calls from people panicking that they can't go without their TikTok. That sounds like addiction to me. That doesn't sound.
Well, but also a lot of businesses rely on TikToks to survive. I mean, that's how that's their marketing tool. I mean, there was one lady in Chicago. She's selling cosmetic line, and if she didn't have TikTok, she wouldn't have a company. So she was going to pursue some legal options.
Good luck.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about that. This bill will not actually ban TikTok in the United States. It would impose very severe civil penalties if it remains foreign controlled.
Okay.
So the choice, and I just read the bill before we came on the air here, because you can't always believe what you read in the news media either. And the way it's set up is there are, I think, $5,000 per user fine, which multiply that by 170 million. That's obviously going to put someone out of business, but only so long as it is a foreign controlled entity. And so there's definition of that. So that's what it does. It says, get the Chinese government out of this app that's on 170 million phones, or you're going to be fined into oblivion. So why aren't they separating it? Why aren't they going to spin it out? Why aren't they going to create, no pun intended, a Chinese wall between the Chinese government and TikTok? That's the question. So that's how it's structured. If this law passes and ByteDance, the parent company, divests itself or spins out TikTok continues. People can still get their fix on it. People can still run their businesses on it. The only way that gets interrupted is if ByteDance, the Chinese company, is so insistent on having access to information on 170 million Americans that they won't spin off the company. So I think the fears of business people who built their businesses around what's alleged to be a Chinese spy app, it will continue as long as that connection is broken.
Let's turn our attention to the Trump trials, both in Manhattan and in Fulton County. So some of the indictments against Trump and associates were dismissed. Some of the charges were dismissed by the judge down there. But there's leave to refile. The problem is for, Fannie Willis or whoever might try that case, is if you attempt to cure those charges that were dismissed, to refile them, you really make it almost impossible that you're going to get to trial before the election, which is the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, and that proves what's wrong with this prosecution. The whole point is to get it to trial before the election, okay? And that's driven all of the cases. And that's what's wrong with these prosecutions of Trump. They are driven by the election. And so they could have been brought 2 years ago. We'd know the answer to all these cases. We know the verdicts in all these cases. But they decided, all of them, to, with the exception of the one about the Mar-a-Lago documents, because that wasn't an old factual claim. It was relatively new. But other than the Florida case, all these prosecutors sat on their cases until the election year, and now they're complaining, oh, you know, we may not get it to trial in time for the election because, look, this defendant's actually defending himself in court on legal grounds. Well, too bad. Okay, and that's the problem in Georgia. I think it's slated for an August 5 trial. They're going to have to re-indict and expand the indictment. I'm not 100% sure on the procedure here, whether they have to reconvene the grand jury or call a new grand jury. I just don't know the answer to that. But it's everybody seems to be in agreement if they have to do that, it's going to reset deadlines. It's going to reset a lot of things, which would make it almost impossible to have it heard before the election. Well, but that shouldn't be the question. The question is, why wasn't this brought a year or two ago?
Yeah. Is there any possibility they can drop the case entirely?
Well, I think the only way that's probably going to happen is if Fannie Willis gets kicked off the case. We don't, I think, have a ruling from the judge yet on that.
No.
I thought they were supposed to come. CNN was reporting that ruling's coming down today.
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
The other case, Manhattan, which is, seems more likely to get to trial, but Trump lawyers are attempting to push it off, which speaks to an understanding that we've been arguing for a long time on this show, that you don't want any of these cases to go to trial before the election. But he's pushing it off, saying that the trial date that's set for March 25th should be stayed until the Supreme Court rules on his immunity claims. What do you think the likelihood of him getting that done in that Manhattan case?
I think very slim. I don't think they're going to stop. I mean, it is a New York State trial, and it is one where the conduct at issue, I think, predated him being president. I have to check that timeline exactly. But this is a books and records case as to how he accounted for certain attorney's fees, basically. And it was alleged that he cooked the books or he manipulated the books to cover up the fact that he was paying Stormy Daniels hush money. I think it's a legally weak case. It's stale. They've invented a novel legal theory to turn it into a felony to extend the statute of limitations. So there's a lot of problems there, but I don't expect a judge in New York State to say, well, because you might have immunity from prosecution, you might, depending on what the Supreme Court rules, from prosecution, you know, when you were in your capacity as president, has nothing to do with what your business did, you know, with regard to paying money to somebody. So it's in my mind, flimsy, frivolous, legally unsound indictment of him in prosecution. But I don't see a judge saying, well, let's put it all on hold. So I think that one's going to go to trial. That will be probably the only one we get before the election.
Professor William Jacobson, clinical professor of law, director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School, founder of LegalInsurrection.com. President of the Legal Insurrection Foundation, also the Equal Protection Project. Professor Jacobson, thank you as always.
Great, thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Biden administration is reportedly discussing using Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, as a migrant center to process Haitian migrants in the event there's a mass exodus from Haiti to the United States, which
is happening.
It's happening as obviously likely, considering that Haiti apparently is descended into warlordocracy, with the top warlord reportedly being a guy named Barbecue who eats people.
Oh, God, that's so gross. And yesterday they stopped a boat that had 60 Haitians on it from entering the Florida coast. So they're coming.
Well, the Dominicans certainly are not going to take them, as has been their recent history. CBS reporting.
As Haiti's political future hangs in the balance, the neighboring Dominican Republic is cracking down on undocumented Haitians, rounding them up and sending them back to their country.
¿Qué pasó?
Que nos tratan como perro.
They treat us like dogs, this man told us after he was released, adding we were detained since yesterday with no food, nothing.
This is the fourth truck that we've seen here in just the past 4 hours. This is a scene that happens every day here at the border.
Earlier in the day, this woman collapsed as she was being taken off an overcrowded immigration truck. Haitian American Dana Josephs happened to be driving by, put her in the back of his truck, and rushed her to the hospital.
It could be my family, but even though I don't even know her. So this is my car that I have to use just to save her life. I'll do it.
These scenes at the border comes at a moment of desperation for Haiti after a coalition of Haitian stakeholders and international leaders, including the U.S.
Yeah, it's really a tale of two countries there in Hispaniola, which we'll have to discuss in more detail another time. But they're not coming to the Dominican, and they're not coming to Florida. Ron DeSantis tweeting out, for quite some time, the state of Florida has been dedicating significant resources to combat illegal vessels coming from Florida to countries such as Haiti. Given the circumstances in Haiti, I've directed the Division of Emergency Management, the Florida State Guard, and state law enforcement agencies to deploy over 250 additional officers and soldiers and over a dozen air and sea craft to the southern coast of Florida to protect our state. No state has done more to supplement the underfunded U.S. Coast Guard's interdiction efforts. We cannot have illegal aliens coming to Florida, period. Well, one place that may accept them, and I don't mean to be dismissive of the plight of Haitians who now have a legitimate asylum claim to make. I'm more dismissive of the political idiocy that informs our border security policy. Mayor Eric Adams tweeting out, this is just, honestly, this is the byproduct of the identitarian addled mind. We call New York City the port of Prince of America.
What?
We feel the pain of our Haitian neighbors. We feel the pain our Haitian neighbors feel as the situation grows dire. To the people of Haiti and our own Haitian community here in New York City, know that we stand with you today and always. The reader added contact to the Mayor Adams, the community notes essentially on Twitter to this. This was great. Important context. No one other than Eric Adams has called New York City the Port-au-Prince of America.
Has he been to Port-au-Prince? The heck is he talking about?
It's just trying to emote, emote and express solidarity and so forth. But he's just so ham-handed because he's a political hack, as all these people we talk about, with few exceptions, are. One of those exceptions is our next guest. He's Rodney Scott. He's the retired chief of United States Border Patrol and now a distinguished senior fellow at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Rodney Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on this morning. Really appreciate that.
So what do you think of this loose talk about standing up a migrant camp at Gitmo to process Haitian escapees?
Yeah, that's one of the first rational things I've heard out of this administration. Gitmo just provides space. It's a military base to provide processing off of the continent of the United States. It's a good thing to keep people from having free access to the entire United States, especially when you can't really vet them. Unfortunately, though, Haiti's a mess, and they're going to kind of have to get their own act together at some point in time. The United States just simply cannot be a refuge for every person in the world from a country that they've failed to manage on their own. And that's kind of what the Biden administration's policies have been, is just a complete open door until now. It's not sustainable.
Well, the concern, too, even if Gitmo is a good way station for now, is what the Biden administration policy has been in terms of these clandestine flights moving migrants around the country, which they have been doing for some time now. We know we have this Center for Immigration Studies document this through a FOIA lawsuit that they filed, you know, 43 airports and tens of thousands of migrants that this administration has taken from the southern border or from foreign countries and flown into this country. Why wouldn't they do the same with Haitians at Gitmo?
Yeah, and just to clarify three distinct different issues, and Americans should be concerned about all of them. That 320,000 that was referenced in that report, those are people that have been flown from outside the country directly to airports inside the United States under the parole programs, that CBP One app. There are people that don't have any right to come in the United States. They don't have any immigration documents, but this administration is basically open to flow. There's hundreds of thousands of others that literally are being released by Border Patrol or ICE at the border and through FEMA grant funding, again, your tax dollars, it's supposed to be for sheltering and services after natural disasters. The federal government is giving all that money to non-governmental organizations, and they're putting them on commercial flights, flying them anywhere in the United States they would like to go. And we've got about 10 million illegal aliens have entered this country under the Biden administration, and there hasn't been a single effort, a single program put in place to slow down that flow. All those combined are a significant problem. The good part about Gitmo traditionally is that is not technically the United States. It's just the United States base. So we can actually repatriate people back to Haiti in theory. I just doubt that this administration would do that.
Now, as someone who was able to work for both the Trump administration and the Biden administration, what were some attributes about Trump that you liked the most?
He listened. A couple of things. First off, the biggest difference between Biden and Trump, or actually I would even go past President Trump in every administration I worked for, is we had a mindset of deterrence, preventing crime before it happened, preventing illegal aliens before they happened. The Biden administration flipped that upside down. They basically told the career government border security experts to go sit in a closet. They brought in political appointees to make all the decisions about how this country enforces the laws on our border. And then they redirected all the funding that's normally towards enforcement and deterrent into expediting the processing, speeding up how fast CBP and Border Patrol can process people. And that results in releasing them into the U.S. They call home, tell their friends and family what happened, and that's why we have this tidal wave of illegal immigration today. Both, I do want to point out, though, both administrations, every administration I worked with was compassionate. But the Biden administration has allowed our American compassion to be hijacked by people around the world with not our best interests at heart. The Trump administration and prior administrations put America's interests first and helped others when we could.
Well, the other thing, and this is a point that Tom Homan makes all the time about our compassion and empathy for our fellow man, you know, we're not blaming people that are coming to this country that seek a better life, and they're doing so at the invitation of our government. So we should be focused on why our government is extending those invitations. But the point that Tom Homan always makes is that a secure border is also a safe border. When you make the border less secure, you endanger the lives not just of Border Patrol agents, first and foremost, but also of people that are trying to come to this country for a better life, because they're making dangerous trips they wouldn't otherwise be making, and doing so at the hands of dangerous people in often cases because of our invitation to come.
Tom's 100% accurate, and that's the whole concept about hijacking our compassion. And I'll give you some examples, because sometimes people have a hard time making it tangible. Specifically at the border, for no matter what the reason is that these people are coming, they're cutting the line in front of legal immigrants. But just by being there, they're providing the cartel a distraction. So the cartel pushes illegal aliens across the border that are willing to surrender and try to claim asylum. That overwhelms local law enforcement so that the cartel can make more money on bringing in the second wave of people that are willing to pay more to avoid law enforcement. Those are the criminals. Those are the people that are afraid to get fingerprinted. And all the narcotics. The other aspect, though, is the Border Patrol doesn't have time to do deep dive interviews. So more children are at risk today of being trafficked into the United States right under the nose and watch of Customs and Border Protection and Border Patrol simply because they don't have the tools or the time to be able to do deep dive interviews. You know, whether it's children, whether it's the migrants that are being raped as they're coming up through Mexico, or whether it's literally just the chaos of the border and the crime that it's allowing to take place. There is nothing compassionate at all about a chaotic border. And as Tom also says, and I agree with him 100%, tell me a downside of a secure border. Tell me a downside of a secure home, because this is our national home. There isn't one.
Rodney Scott, retired chief, United States Border Patrol, distinguished senior fellow now at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Rodney Scott, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll have you back soon. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I think we're going to have someone from Food for the Poor on to give us a first-person account of what's happening on the ground in Haiti, so that'll be helpful. In the interim, just speaking as we were with Rodney Scott about this nation's orientation in a good way to being compassionate and empathetic and inclined to be their brother's keeper, I think, many of us at least, but for the new Marxist movement and the pollution that movement has delivered onto our government and so many of our institutions. Let me give you an example, these little stories that give at least me some hope for Western civilization, hopefully you as well. It's a story about students at Providence College. Hey, they're moving on. They play Creighton today.
Oh, yeah, good.
Got past Georgetown yesterday.
If they win, are they going to make it to the big dance?
I think they're going to have. They're definitely going to have to beat Creighton. I think they're going to have to win one more to be in that conversation. Otherwise, I think they're NIT bound. But anyway.
We're going to do our brackets this year, right?
Sure.
Okay.
So Providence College students became friendly with the security guard in their residential hall where they live. His name is James. He's from Nigeria, and he hasn't seen his family, including his son, in more than a decade. So here's what they did.
On the fourth floor, they tell me the community they have built is a family, and the bond they've created with James, their overnight security guard in the dorm, has become a part of that. These students decided to surprise James Wednesday night with the funds to travel home to see his family all the way in Nigeria.
Once we learned that James hadn't seen his family in over a decade, that's kind of what kickstarted this for us.
For a group of Providence College students living on the fourth floor of Raymond Hall, family is not necessarily by blood.
We take care of our own, and we firmly believe that James is one of our own.
These students set up a GoFundMe just last week, getting over 230 donations and raising just shy of $7,000. An envelope with $3,000 given to their dorm security guard Wednesday night to fulfill his dream of flying home to Nigeria to see his family after 11 years.
Someone that you're drawn towards, just really kind, compassionate. After a long day, you go out on a Friday night after class, and you come back, James is there.
Oh, and then they never saw him again.
No, he's just kidding. They ended up raising, like, I think, at least last count, like more than 11 grand for him to
Good.
Go see his family and come
Fly
back.
Fly first class, buddy.
So the idea, like, again, just thinking about our immigration system and what we're doing here. So you have James, who here is in this country legally, and he's working, and he hasn't seen his family. And so you would think, like, a family reunification with James, the security guard at Providence College, would be more of a priority than flying people, as we were just talking about with Rodney Scott, from foreign lands because they signed up on some CBP app to this country that have no papers and very little vetting, if any, Customs and Border Patrol tell us.
I know, and I just got a phone call, and I had some pictures sent to me from my friends that live around the Gage Park place. They're having a press conference on Sunday at 11:30 because they've had enough. They have videos of people urinating in their yards, drinking beer and throwing it, trash everywhere, stealing their packages from their front porch. They, you know, and their Democratic friends tell them, oh, just move. No, they should move. I shouldn't have to move. They should, and they've had enough. So they're going to try and do what they did at Amundsen Park, at the Amundsen Fieldhouse, and try and get them kicked out.
I don't know what you're talking about, because that is not what's happening, according to Joy Reid.
I will note for our audience that overall crime is down this year across this country, and migrant crime is negligible. Crime by migrants is negligible.
Well, so that's the opposite of the compassion for our fellow man we were talking about, with the number of people who've been murdered, just that have cases have bubbled to public knowledge in the last week that we've talked about, in addition to all the violence that's happening at the border, including to migrants, all the violence that is happening at the hands of people associated with international gangs that have been let in, fentanyl, the poisoning of America's youth, the fentanyl trafficking, the human trafficking. Who do you think is doing that? The Mormon Tabernacle Choir? But this is the attitude. That's the attitude.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can always reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break. And I think when we get back, we're going to have someone from Food for the Poor to give us some perspective on what the administration is proposing with respect to the Haitians who are trying to flee their country, what's happening on the ground there, and what they're trying to do to save as many lives as they can by providing the food and water that certainly
the need's not going to go away.
warlords who've taken over the country are not going to provide. We'll be right back.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, all right, as promised, we have one of our friends from Food for the Poor. He's the chief operating officer of Food for the Poor Haiti. Ken Michael joins us. Ken, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, this is Paul Jacobs with Food for the Poor. Ken is on his way down to the studio. I apologize. We have got a lot of things happening, a lot of moving parts today, as you can well imagine.
Okay, no problem. All right, well, Paul, so tell us what we should know about what's happening on the ground in Haiti and what if anything, Food for the Poor is able to do as chaos is reigning.
As you can well imagine, the civil unrest and a lot of things that have been changing and taking place in Haiti has put Food for the Poor at a very, and a lot of organizations, a lot of communities, at a standstill. But Food for the Poor is uniquely positioned that when roads open up, when peace or at least a state of stability for at least a few days are available, we can start moving again. We have trucks, we have containers, we have got all of the resources that families need to resume providing food, resume providing resources to those beneficiaries that we have on the ground. We just really need some peace at this moment, some stability, so that we can send our drivers and we send all of our staff out into the communities where we serve in safety.
Well, they just had 3,500 people, you know, released from prison. You know, the gangs went in there and opened up the doors. Do your people on the ground, because sometimes, you know, gangs get along with people who are trying to provide humanitarian aid. Is that even remotely possible right now?
You know, that's a great question. We're not, of course, the gangs understand that the gangs have an agenda.
Right.
So do the people that are riding, so do the people that are trying to get aid out to these families. Food for the Poor's main focus is right now is to make sure that we stay clear of anything that is dangerous, because our staff, 100% of our staff, are Haitian nationals living in the country. Their families live in the communities where a lot of these people have been affected. So we are 1,000% focused on making sure that our ministry partners get the resources that they need so that we can get started feeding families and getting emergency resources back into the communities as we normally do.
How are you able to protect your caches of food and water and materials from these, you know, roving warlords?
Well, you know, we definitely have security, and we definitely have we have people that are helping us in securing our resources But we really have sorry, Ken just walked in, so I'm going to hand this over to him in about one moment. But okay. We have security that is aiding and assisting our trucks and our resources on the ground. But let me give you Ken Michelle, our COO from our Haiti office. He can better answer your question here. Hold on.
All right.
Oh, I love Ken.
Good morning.
Morning, Ken. Thanks for joining us. So we were just talking to Paul and was just asking how difficult it is or how you go about protecting all the resources that have been supplied down through your supply chain, through Food for the Poor supply chain, the food, the water, the other materials, how you protect those resources for the people of Haiti when you have the country in chaos as it is now.
Well, then I have to say, for now, we've decided since the chaos really started about 15 days ago to halt operations and secure facilities. The reality is that before, there were some corridors that we called humanitarian corridors that allowed us to serve our beneficiaries. In the last 2 weeks, those corridors have not been open, and we felt for the benefit of the employees, for the safety of the products we have, it was best that we did not try to distribute. We have today in our warehouse about the equivalent of, I would say, 80 to 100 container trailers in inventory. And at port, we have, I was on a meeting this morning with the staff, we have about 119 containers at port. We are currently seeing with UN OSHA how we can find a humanitarian corridor to pull those containers out. It's not just for Food for the Poor. There are other partners such as CRS and such as the other partners of the UN network that have containers, and they're trying to see how those could be safely moved out of the port. The next step of the challenge, which we don't have yet, is how we're going to distribute, because the gangs still control all the roads to the different regions or communities where people are in need of assistance.
Well, how did you escape? When did you leave Haiti?
Escape.
It's okay.
No, no, it's
okay. I'm sorry.
No. It's no. I was invited to participate. Food for the Poor is not just a disaster relief and response entity. We are engaged in development. And I was attending a conference on agriculture that was held in Florida. I traveled normally on the, I believe, February 27th or 28th, that Wednesday, attended the conference on Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It ended up Saturday midday. And the flight being mid-morning, I traveled. I was supposed to travel on Sunday. As I was at the gate, 10 minutes into boarding, they told us that the plane would not depart. I have left my wife and kids in country. But we believe the Lord is great, powerful, plentiful, and we will wait in due time to go back home. Well, I'm looking at all options.
Can you give us any perspective on what it is like on the ground in and around Port-au-Prince right now?
So I can tell you that I would say there are three Port-au-Prince into Port-au-Prince, if I may define it like that. There is one Port-au-Prince, which is the port and the heavily gang-dominated area. Which is where nobody goes. Nobody's entitled to go. Even the police will not go. There is a Port-au-Prince, I would call it Tier 2, which is the port and the airport, where the gangs want to be in control, but they are from time to time pushed out by the police or the army or the private forces that some of the facilities have. The third tier is the Port-au-Prince that we all live in, but where the gangs come in from time to time and create chaos, have kidnappings, and you never know. So that third tier is where my family resides, where I will go back, hopefully, on the next opening I find to do the work that we have to do until we pray that the country will come back to what it used to be, what I was brought in, not what I'm living today.
Yeah. Are we to believe some of the reporting about some of these gang leaders? I'm sure you've seen the caricatures or the characterizations. I don't know if they're caricatures. They may be 100% accurate. Like this dude Barbecue, who's supposedly a cannibal, and his G9 and family gang. I mean, are these guys as bad as they're reported to be?
I would like to say, Dan, that some of these guys, so, you know, to go about Barbecue, he was an ex-police officer. The motto of the police is to protect and to serve. If you entered to protect and to serve, I do not believe you were initially what you are today. However, I was also taught, and maybe I was properly taught, but maybe again, you know, there were errors in my education, that the devil was one of the angels, yet he decided to challenge the Lord and to become his own master. So I do not know, and I cannot justify. I can tell you that I've had employees kidnapped. We had to, through their families, support, negotiate, and pray for their release. I had a friend that was just kept for 4 months into detention. But I realized that the situation is not just one in Haiti. I will say, in a bad English, I've also been kidnapped. Here I am. I can't go back home because the gangs took over the airport. Now, nobody's holding me here. Yes,
we've got to leave it there. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I so appreciate your time. Ken Michel, the COO of Food for the Poor in Haiti, thank you so much, and good luck reuniting with your family as soon as possible.
Thank you, and looking forward to do the work for Food for the Poor back in Haiti.
Yes. God bless you. We will definitely be praying for your family. Thank you so much, Ken.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.